Ready to proceed?
Chief Justice Steele, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Thomas C. Marconi, Esquire, and I am counsel to the appellant, Vandalay Industries, LLC. First, I'd like to point out just a few important facts that I think are useful in the analysis of the legal issues in this case. These are all, of course, supported on the record of the proceedings below. The first is that these defendants were well aware of the existence of this easement at the time that they commenced the development of the property. It was shown on their record plan. An actual configuration of it was shown on their record plan submitted to Newcastle County, and the deed record showing or indicating the location of the deed where the easement was described was also specifically set forth on that record plan. The defendants also knew that Vandalay specifically objected to any encroachments in the easement area. Mr. Yankoski, Jason Yankoski, who is one of the managing members of Vandalay, contacted a representative of the defendants named Bruce Manley and specifically said to him, "We have rights in this easement area, and we understand that you may be making improvements in that area, and we object to that." Essentially, Mr. Manley's response was that they didn't recognize the easement. They didn't feel as though the easement existed any longer, and basically weren't going to worry about the easement in terms of their plans for improving the property. Naturally, with that kind of a response, Mr. Yankoski contacted our office. Shortly after we were hired, sent a letter to counsel to the defendants saying, you know, again, we have an easement in this area. We have an objection to you in any way making any improvements in that easement. And would you consider entering into a standstill agreement just for a brief period so that we can discuss some kind of an amicable resolution of this thing? Subsequent follow-up telephone calls were made following that letter, and we attached a copy of a form standstill agreement with the letter. But the letter and subsequent telephone calls to counsel just were completely ignored. They just really did not respond in any way. So in light of that, and seeing that the improvements were moving along, we felt we didn't have any choice except to file suit in Chancery Court in May of 2002, early May, and we sought an injunction, both a permanent and a preliminary injunction, to stop the defendants from constructing their improvements in our easement area. In response to our request for a preliminary injunction, the Vice Chancellor held a teleconference in late May of 2002, and essentially at the conclusion of the teleconference, and I think rightfully so, he said, "Well, you're not using the easement," which we weren't. "You don't have any plans to use the easement," which we didn't, and we still don't. No concrete plans anyway.
Well, he found that you did have an easement.
He did, Your Honor.
And he found that there was an encroachment on that easement, correct?
Eventually he did.
All right. And was there any type of injunctive restraint to stop the improvements that were being, that were ongoing, or was that done voluntarily?
There was no, Your Honor, as far as I know, there was never any cessation in the defendant's plan or delay in the defendant's plan to make the improvements.
Did they make the improvements?
They did. They, without any hesitation and really without any consideration.
So by the time you got to final judgment or near final judgment, that was already an accomplished fact.
It was finished.
So yeah. The only issue was whether the court should require all of that to be undone.
That's correct.
And the court said, well, I'll do that as soon as you can show me that you have a need for this easement, that is to use the easement. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you're appealing from only that portion of the order. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That is the portion of the order that, in effect, declined to require an immediate undoing of the improvements.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why did the court err in that regard?
Because the court's decision was based on an analysis that this court held in the Richard Pauling case is improper. What the court did was it said, well, the benefit to the plaintiff of having the improvements removed immediately is far less than the detriment that's going to befall the defendants if they're required to remove the improvements now. And we submit that that is an improper consideration in the context of a final order on the issue of an encroachment of an existing easement.
I have two questions. At any point during the telephone call that you described, or any point between that telephone call and the enter of the final judgment below, did the vice chancellor ever tell your opponents you build at your own risk?
At least twice in the May 22nd, 2002 telephone conference on the preliminary injunction hearing, he did say, and counsel did acknowledge, that yes, we build at our own risk.
Second question is, in order to affirm the vice chancellor's balancing of the equities here, do we have to overrule the Paul case? Or is it factually distinguishable in any way?
I believe you do have to overrule it,
Why?
Mr. Chief Justice. Because the Paul case specifically says that absent some kind of an equity or an estoppel that goes against the plaintiff, or some equity that goes in favor of the defendant, in the context of a final order, when you've got a vested property right that nobody disputes, and you've got no dispute about the fact that these improvements interfere with that property right, once you have that, if you don't have any equities on either side, you cannot consider the balancing. You cannot say, well, it's going to be so onerous on the defendant, and it will be really no problem for the plaintiff to keep these improvements here. You can't make that kind of an analysis.
But why doesn't that case read on all fours with your client's position?
I believe it does, Your Honor.
So if that's the case, you don't need to argue that we should overrule Paul, do you?
No, but
your argument is that there is no right. The other side had no right recognizable in equity or cognizable in equity, and there was no estoppel.
That's correct.
And those are the only exceptions to the rule, if I understand the case right, that there would have to be a removal of any encroachment or obstacle to the use of the easement.
I agree, Your Honor. I misunderstood Mr. Chief Justice.
No, you answered me correctly. I think the question that I asked may have been misunderstood. I ask you, if we were to affirm, would we have to overrule Paul? You obviously don't want us to affirm, so you're not suggesting that Paul should be overruled.
No.
Is there any difference in this case caused by the fact that the vice chancellor left open, in the event you get your curb cut one day and can use the easement for some practical purpose, I'll then reconsider it and order them to tear down whatever improvement's been made? Does that make any difference in this case?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. His July 18, 19, or 2005 order doesn't even require us to go back. I mean, I guess we'd have to go back and show our curb cut, but that order already says if you get approvals, it's all got to come down. It only makes a difference if there's a focus on the plaintiff's damages and there's a focus on the plaintiff's conduct. I don't think that is the focus of the line of cases, the Richard Paul case in the cases we've cited out of Illinois, in the case we cited out of Rhode Island.
Have your clients gotten any compensation whatsoever for this use of the easement?
Your Honor, the only thing my clients have gotten for the use of the easement is a fairly sizable legal bill.
Well, most people consider that no compensation at all. But is Dunkin' Donuts, on the other hand, paying your opponents anything?
I have no idea about that.
Was there ever any record on whether they're receiving money from anyone else as they use your client's easement?
I have no idea about that, and there is no record of that below.
I think that the Chief Justice's comments raise a line of inquiry that was in my mind, and that is your client is not using the easement. That's undisputed, right?
Correct.
And therefore, at least as things stand right now, is not damaged by what your opponents have done, even though it is an encroachment. It has not interfered with anything you are doing or would like to do with that easement, correct?
You know, I would agree with that, except I would sort of carve out the term damage.
Okay, and what I'm getting at is I saw something in the record indicating that the value of your property is enhanced by having this easement, right?
There was an appraisal that said that it added $50,400 to the value of the property.
Okay, and what I'm getting at is that although I realize land is unique and all that good stuff in terms of equity, under the circumstances of this case, why is damages not an appropriate remedy?
Your Honor, I don't know how you would calculate. I'm not saying that damages are not an appropriate remedy, although I'm not sure exactly how you would calculate what is the value of a piece of real estate that, or an interest in real estate that somebody is basically forced to sell. I think that's what would really be. I mean, if someone said, well, we're not going to order the improvements removed, but you have to sell or you have to pay money to Vandalay defendants, how do you calculate the value of that? I mean, can you get an appraisal and then add 20% because it's a forced conveyance?
Wouldn't you do it like an analogy to condemnation? This is almost a private condemnation, so the measure of damages is the value of the land left after the taking of the easement. And that becomes a question, is it worth $50,400 less or not, or some other number, or some greater or lesser number?
I suppose that's, if you had to do it, that perhaps would be...
This is like a private taking without compensation. It's a condemnation of your property right.
I suppose, although, Your Honor, I am unaware of there's no such thing as a private taking, obviously. The law says that if you've got vested...
There isn't until it happens, and that's what's happened here, appears.
It appears...
Your property right, whatever it may be, has been taken by another party. They're using it, and you've not been compensated for it in any way.
That's true. Now, the case...
But as I understand it, it's someone else's property. Your client has an easement across someone else's property.
Correct.
And it appears in the record that the property owner said... They have an easement. They're not using it. I'm going to build in the easement. And your client wanted their rights vindicated in the easement, which the Court of Chancery has done. So my question is, why hasn't your client gotten complete relief when the Court of Chancery says your client's right to the easement is recognized and they can invoke their right to use it anytime they want and the buildings have to be torn down?
Well, I think it's sort of the same, Your Honor, as was the case in Richard Paul, that the dominant estate had an easement on the 9th Street side and the Walnut Street side of the building, and the defendants in that case made some reconfigurations to the property and essentially closed off the Walnut Street side and said, you know, the 9th Street side, it's the same access. You can get in and out. It's just as easy. And the Chancery Court found that what they were substituted with was just as convenient as the as what they had before, and the Supreme Court agreed, yep, it's on the record, it looks like it was just as convenient as it was before, but that's not the point. You cannot force the dominant estate to take anything less than it was given.
Does the vice chancellor have the authority to give your opponent 6 months to tear down the wall?
I would say he does.
Does the vice chancellor then have the authority to give your opponent until such time as you have a use for the property to tear down the wall?
Your Honor, it depends upon what that decision is based on. If that decision was based on the fact that we maybe sat on our rights or we didn't make it known to the defendants that we had a problem with what they were doing, I think the case...
Are both of these questions of timing?
No, I think they could be, but I think they're more questions of how you deal with the conduct of the defendants. You can't just decide that you're going to do, as Mr. Chief Justice says, a private taking, and there'd be virtually no consequences to you. I was trying to think of an analogy. It was hard for me to do, but I sort of thought of a situation where, let's say I go on vacation to Australia for 6 months, and of course I leave my house, and my house is of no use to me whatsoever in Australia. I'm living in a hotel room. I don't need my house. I can't see my house. I can't use my house. If a third party moves into my house and starts using it, as long as he wants, without my permission, but when I come back, there's no change whatsoever. Every magazine is exactly the way it was on that coffee table, and every bed is perfectly made, and it is just as though that person was never there. Have I been damaged? I think I have.
Can we get back? It may not be for this court to be looking into this issue, and I may be the only one on this court who's talking about it, but has your client expressed an interest in resolving this matter through the payment of money?
Yes.
And it just has not worked out?
Correct.
Okay, so in other words, it's either undo the construction that you've done or pay me, and since they don't want to pay you, you want them to undo the construction.
Correct. Well, Your Honor, we want the easement area to be the way it was before the encroachments.
Right.
If they want to, we were always willing to negotiate purchase of the easement rights. I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that. But all we're asking for is what the law says that we're entitled to, namely what an unencumbered easement that's the one described in our deed.
You want to save the rest of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Let me start where I left off with your opposing counsel. You're playing chicken here, right?
I think what we're playing is, as I once described in another matter in the district court, it's a relative game of high-stakes poker, but quite frankly, it's more simply, there were several questions put to my friend, Mr. Marconi, that I hope I get. It seems to me, and I've said this ad nauseum in my brief, and there's no use. It's not about chicken. We've been imposed the responsibility that should Mr. Marconi's client step forward and say, I can use the property, that we have to take out the wall.
Well, let's suppose that he comes in tomorrow and says, I've got this easement, and I just want to walk up and down the easement every day. I want to ride my bike up and down the easement. I want to have a picnic in the easement, but we'll assume it's a pass-through. But he says, I just want to walk up and down it every day. Will your clients tear down the buildings?
Well, let me back up, please, if I may. First off, There's a factual issue here because this property was not developed in any way before we put the wall in. It was a slope from one grade to another. That's what the easement was. And secondly, and importantly, the easement is for ingress and egress only. So if that includes walking up and down and using my bicycle, I suppose that's a different question, and if the chancellor or the vice chancellor's order reaches that, then we would have to take it out. But bear in mind, none of those hypotheticals were ever tabled.
Well, I understand, but Justice Berger's question and a lot of the court's questions go to whether or not at some point in time people are going to continue to be reasonable. So at least on your opponent's side, they're saying, look, I can't get a curb cut, I can't get vehicular traffic in there, so I really don't have a use, I can tell you, for the easement. They haven't said, I want to walk in and out, I want to ride my bicycle. And on the other hand, your clients seem to be saying, look, whether you've got the easement or not, you're not using it, we're building there, and if you come up with a use, call us. Isn't that pretty much where we are?
That is pretty much where we are. And to come back to the nub of it, that's where we're allowed to be.
And so my question is, what if your opponent says, all right, I just want to ride my bicycle in and out, and I want to swerve back and forth over the full part of the easement, where are we going to be?
I don't think that comes within the four corners of the easement as granted, and that would be my response.
So if your opponent wants to sell the current property they have, they get to sell ongoing litigation with it?
Well, they get to sell what is an assured right provided for by the order of the lower court, that if you can get DelDOT or whoever to approve a curb cut, that's going to be clean. They get what they bargained for.
But that's, no, the easement says ingress and egress.
Right.
And my question is, if they decide they want to use it for ingress and egress for foot traffic or bicycle traffic, something like that, why aren't they entitled to do that?
If that falls within the parameters of the easement, they would be entitled to do that. But again, after 2.5 years or so before Vice Chancellor Noble, that was never even positive. I think it's important, and I respect and appreciate that we're dealing with the big picture issue and that Richard Paul may have to be reversed or not, or modified or not. But the key here is litigants came to the Court of Chancery and not once was any possible use articulated. And that was the conclusion of the lower court, and I don't think we can find fault with that. The problem is, what should happen now?
Well, let's go back to the analogy of your client moving into the other side's house. Let's assume that opposing counsel's client is living in Australia or simply is a wealthy person and has several houses and doesn't need to be living in the one at issue.
Right.
Your client just decides to move in because opposing counsel's client has no need for that house. Aren't you arguing, your client would be entitled to stay there until the other side comes in and says, no, I have a use for that house now.
Well, let me respond respectfully that if I own the house, and that's the key, if I own the house that he's living in, because I own the property that the easement is on. And as the servient
state,
you're talking about I can use the property.
Talking about the difference between fee, title, and an easement.
Well, I'm talking about a third party, which was Mr. Marconi's.
Well, we're both talking about property rights, aren't we?
Yeah.
And
yes,
this
sir.
and Mr. Marconi's client has a property right. Maybe less than fee simple, but it's a property right, and your client has interfered with it.
Well, I think that, and again, that is
the lower
court
so found.
I don't think my client has interfered with it because it's never been used. There's no case that I could find, and trust me, I looked, where an easement that had been given was never used and was a subject of litigation. It just isn't out there.
An easement is an easement. It's a property right. And
agreed.
If your client builds a wall across it, it is interfering with that easement, whether it's being used or not. Isn't that correct?
I don't agree, Your Honor, respectfully. And if you go back, if you look at this court's opinion in Copeland, which was in 1996, Justice Berger wrote it, it tracks conclusions of law that have been upheld by the courts of Delaware since 1912, beginning in Williamson versus McMonagall. And it says that what constitutes interference with reasonable use, when evaluating that, one must consider the purposes of the easement, the nature and situation of the property, and the manner in which it has been used and occupied. And all that the Vice Chancellor did was exactly that. In addition to obviously bringing to bear the equitable powers to frame a remedy, as Justice Holland recognized, that would protect this right, he said, this is what I'm doing.
Well, the issue that I'll give you a chance to address, since you wanted to answer some of the questions that were asked before, let me give you at least one little modest question. What do we do about Paul? And isn't Paul directly applicable here?
The Paul case is an alternative use case which distinguishes it right away. When you read Paul, I cannot read Paul without the facts of Paul. The facts of Paul talk in a number of places about the 15 years of use that attended that alley. Now, the use issue is reflected in, I think it's, I can't remember the name of the case, Edgell versus Diver, where the court in Chancery noted that once used, the easement becomes fixed and neither party can change it. But my point simply is you can't read Paul without the facts of Paul. If you're going to say, and by the way, the key in my mind in Paul is that the court there said in three different places that it is a, this is a proper case for equitable remedy. This is proper circumstances for equitable remedy. I'd have to find it if I can.
Well, while you're looking for that, let me read an excerpt from Paul and just tell you straight up, this is the excerpt that has my interest for whatever ultimate result. Conditions may not be imposed to deprive a plaintiff of his full legal rights unless they secure an equitable right belonging to the defendant. So first, what is your equitable right? Or unless they secure to the defendant some matter which the plaintiff is estopped to deny. And what should stop the plaintiff in this case in the face of this clear legal right to the easement?
Okay, I think there were two parts that were directed to specifically at my client, and first is what legal right does my client have? And as the case law...
No, it was what equitable right do you have? We know what your legal right is. You're the simple owner of the property that's subject to somebody else's clear legal right to an easement. So, what equitable right are you trying to secure here, and what has the plaintiff done that would stop him from denying it to you and allow you to use his easement?
I don't know that there is an equitable right that I'm trying to secure. I'm not sure that's responsive, but I don't see an equitable issue as much as I have a right.
Well, Paul seems to suggest, at least to me, that the easement creates a clear legal right to the owner's use of the easement, whether he uses it or not, whether he has plans to use it or not. But that can be interfered with if there's an equitable claim or right of yours apart from your fee simple ownership of the underlying land, or the plaintiff has done something that stops him from your use of the easement. Now, in either case, what are the facts that suggest that you have some equitable claim to use of that easement, or that the plaintiff has, by his own actions, stopped himself from being able to assert his legal right to use of the easement?
Well, I confess to you that I cannot, as I stand here, think of an equitable right that my client has. And in the same breath...
Something's got to, it seems to me, if you read Paul, and if Paul is applicable, something has to say the legal right of the plaintiff to a secure use of the easement, whether he's actually using it or not, can only be overcome by some other right in equity. How do you overcome his clearly?
Well, I don't think I overcome his equity claim in that respect. I think his equity claim doesn't come to bear unless I am found to have wronged his use of the property. And
well,
that's why,
as I understood your argument, although I'm not suggesting an answer to you, but your clients basically knew they were subject to this easement that hadn't been used for years and years and years and years. Then they found a use for the property. So whether we call it equities or not, your client is saying, look, it's my land. I can put it to good use if you're not going to use that easement, but I understand that you've got a right to use it, and if you ever need it, I'll quit using it and give you full access to the easement. Isn't that really what your client's saying?
That's exactly what the vice chancellor did, and That's why we didn't take an appeal ourselves.
Well, to follow up on the Chief Justice's question, or really to repeat his second question, is it also the case that you're not claiming that there's an estoppel here, that is, that the plaintiff is stopped from taking the position that the plaintiff has taken?
I struggle with the question as framed. I'm sorry.
Well, let's go back to Paul. They're basically, as Paul reads on this case, your client should be required to eliminate or undo the obstruction to the right-of-way, the easement, unless what your client has done is needed to secure a right cognizable in equity, and you say that doesn't apply, or the plaintiff, the other party, is stopped from taking the position that it has taken. All I'm asking is do you argue here that there's some estoppel?
No, what I would respond by saying that, and you can't lose fact, you can't lose the fact that Paul is an alternative use case. And so the equities come to bear in what are you giving up and who's suffering a burden, and that's why the court went in the way it did with that analysis, I believe. But that's not what is here.
You're arguing that Paul doesn't really stand for a broad proposition of law.
It only applies in the narrow situation
where there is an alternative use
problem.
Is it your position that the easement doesn't ripen, that is the easement in this case, did not or will not ripen into a property right until it's used? I mean, is that at the heart of your position?
I think that is at the heart of it. I think that is the trend.
There can be no such thing as an inchoate easement, that is a right to use of access over somebody's property.
There certainly can be, but in terms of getting a legal remedy for that inchoate right, you come back to the cases over the years that say you have to evaluate the use of the property. And if there was no use, there can be no harm. And if there is no harm, there should be no remedy. And that is exactly the trend taken in the restatement third of property for servitude. They say exactly that.
Well, if the record shows there's some value enhancement to the balance of the plaintiff's property by having this easement, or flip the coin and say the easement itself has value and the record reflects that, why is that not reflected in anything that's happened here? Why is there no compensation?
Because nothing's been taken, Your Honor. I appreciate the question, but nothing, it's a logical conundrum. Nothing's been taken because nothing's been used. No rights been denied. If it's merely an inchoate opportunity, and as occurred here, the other side says can't ever use it, what value could that possibly have? Until they demonstrate use, they may have value.
Well, but I thought the record reflected that there was evidence of $50,400 in value.
Well, certainly.
Am I wrong about that?
It is in the record. Well, but it was a part of an appraisal done, I believe, for the other side. It wasn't a part of the contested litigation that I'm aware of.
Oh, it's not part of the record in this case?
It is. It was described in the record below. It was a part of the record. Yeah.
But we just ignore that as of no significance.
I think you do ignore that, because until there's been a harm, how can that trigger a damages claim?
Well, let's explore that. Is it correct that the easement in this case runs solely to the plaintiff?
You mean, would it be transferable or?
No. Can the public generally use?
No, I think it's designed for ingress and egress to the property, and I think in the end it would inure to the benefit of the public. I can't remember where the curb cuts are, but I think it's about ingress and egress to the property, period.
But running to whom?
To the owner of the property.
Oh, no. So the owner of the property would have the exclusive right of ingress and egress?
Of exploiting that easement, yeah.
And the owner of the property, therefore, would be entitled to exclude the rest of the world from ingressing and egressing over that particular strip of land.
It would be his right, yes, I think so.
And the rest of the world would include your client if your client chose to put obstructions on that easement.
If that easement were being used.
Whether it were being used or not.
Well, I don't think that, respectfully, I don't think that's the law in Delaware over the years.
Well, what case says that your client can do what it is doing?
Well, the cases stand for the proposition that I mentioned a minute ago. Number one, the owner of the property, burdened by the easement, can use it so long as he does not unreasonably interfere with the exercise of the easement. And that analysis has always included, going back to 1912, consideration of what use the property is being put to now.
If you're going to say, would you repeat what you just said?
Surely, Your Honor. The cases, as I've read them, stand for the proposition that analysis of whether an easement has been interfered with has to include consideration of the use to which the property is being put. Also, the nature of the easement as granted, the purpose of the easement. And here, as a serving tenant, serving an estate, I have the right to use the property so long as I am not unreasonably encroaching on the exercise of the easement.
So your client, as the owner of the fee simple,
yes, sir,
could use the easement for access and egress?
If the question is premised on the notion that Vandalay is not using it at all, then I would say yes.
Well, but how could you use it for ingress and egress other than a public footpath or a bicycle?
Well, I'm not.
You'd have to have a curb cut too.
Sure, right? I'm not trying to get into the niceties of how that would be accomplished. I'm taking the question more hypothetically.
But we've been into the niceties of how they're not using it. Why aren't we into the niceties of how you would use it for its purpose, which is ingress and egress?
I wouldn't use it. I mean, that's.
Now, is it fair to say that your client wouldn't have built on that easement unless it was profitable to him to do so?
Sure, certainly. I mean, there was a benefit.
So
there.
He can profit from the use of the easement without sharing any of that profit with the owner of the easement.
As long as the easement is not being used. Yes, sir.
The appraisal that's in the record assumes a value, let's just assume it's correct, $50,000 for ingress and egress. Do you think it would still be $50,000 with a wall across it?
I think it would still be $50,000 with the wall if there was a ready opportunity to get the permits needed to develop and use it. That's how I would answer your question, respectfully. If there is no likelihood, as the record below suggests, that it can ever be done, then it's not 50, and it shouldn't be 50. But if there is a realistic opportunity to develop that curb cut with the permission of the authorities that are needed, then it probably still would be 50, whether the wall's there or not, because we're going to have to take the wall down free of charge to Vandalay.
Do you think it's worth $50,000 if there's a condition of litigation that's ongoing? You have to go back to the Court of Chancery or otherwise engage a lawyer to work this out with your client?
Litigation has a price for us all. I can't say that certainly it would impact the value of the property, Your Honor.
And what do you understand the impediments to be to getting the curb cut to use it?
The I don't know if it's the UDC or the DelDOT or whomever, but there's a requirement that if you already have curb cuts for ingress and egress, you can't do it again. I think I'm not a highway lawyer, but that's how I would describe it. And that's apparent here that they have ingress and egress already. That's all. And so we didn't create that impediment with the government authorities. It's just there. In many respects, this is a contract that just went sour for the circumstance. But that doesn't in any way make us evildoers or in any way suggest that we can't continue to do what Delaware law has recognized a serving estate can do for 100 years, which is use it so long as you don't encroach on the exercise of the right.
You define exercise of the right being actual use, walking the easement.
Yes, sir.
As distinguished from exercising a right to exclude the rest of the world from walking along that easement.
Yes, sir. And I don't mean to be redundant, and I think that's all that my brief turned out to be in many respects, but I don't think if it were otherwise, as Vice Chancellor Noble said, you would take out that wall and leave that property fallow in perpetuity until someone, if ever, could demonstrate the opportunity to use it. You know, the new restatement favors the productive use of land. I think, frankly, that's what the history of cases in Delaware favors.
But the alternative is that your client gets to use the land and buys out the easement, and that's not an alternative that you think you need to pursue.
I didn't want to go into the settlement issues per se. I had contacted Mr. Marconi to talk about this, but we just never connected very recently. I mean, that's an argument that troubles me, but it is true that we haven't tried to settle it. We haven't been able to sell it yet, let me put it that way.
I don't think the question was directed to settlement. The question was directed to the alternative to allowing the land to stay fallow is to purchase whatever property right there may be that exists in the easement. And that has not happened.
That has not happened. There have been discussions, and hopefully there will still be, but that has not happened. Anyway.
Thank you.
Lacking anything. Thank you, Your Honor.
Just very quickly, I just wanted to stress, and I don't think this is something that's lost on the court, that use is not the issue. The Renaissance case that we cite, the Leclerc case that we cite, Illinois and Rhode Island, respectively, and a number of cases that are cited in those cases were situations where the court recites in the opinion there was little or no use. In the Renaissance case, the court below said that there was no existing use, and the plans of the dominant estate to use the easement area, it was a cross easement in that situation, are speculative at best. They just really had no plans, just like us. They just didn't have any plans. But the court did not focus on that issue. The issue was, as Chief Justice Steele recited the language from the Richard Paul case, you've got to show some estoppel against the dominant estate or some equity in favor of the Serbian estate before you ever get to the issue of, well, should we consider the harm to the dominant estate of removing these encroachments as opposed to the benefit of the Serbian, the harm to the Serbian estate versus the benefit to the dominant estate. And if that balancing, whichever way that balance goes, that's where we're going to decide.
What do you understand Mr. Bonkowski to have meant when he said Paul is distinguishable because it's an alternate use case?
Well, I'm not sure, Your Honor, although I don't agree with that case. I think that position. Paul is much broader than that. Just the language in Paul on page 55, when after the court discusses the fact that there were no equities in favor of the defendants in that case, and no estoppels against the plaintiff. It said we've got a property right, we've got to protect the property right. That's the starting point. Now, if there are equities and estoppels out here that maybe make us look at it a different way, we will. But if they're not there, we're not going to look at it a different way. The court says the result, therefore, is that a clear violation of plaintiff's rights under the lease has been established without the establishment of any counterbalancing equities in the defendant's favor. Under such circumstances, the course of a court of equity is clear. It must follow the law and protect the plaintiff's legal rights.
Well, if you focus on use, it's almost like the other side is suggesting your clients are a stop from asserting their right to the easement because they basically abandon it. They don't use it.
Well, there's an entire body of law on the abandonment area, Your Honor, and when you've got an easement that's specifically described in a meets and bounds description in every deed in the chain of title going back to the 50s, nothing that we've done here comes even close to an abandonment under that body of law. So if that's their argument, I disagree with it.
So your position is there's no room for balancing the equities in a case like this unless the equities rise to the level of an enforceable legal right?
Well, I think...
A right that would be enforceable in equity or a right that would exist by virtue of an estoppel.
Correct. I think if they'd have come to court themselves in January of 2002 or sometime before they forced us to do it, and said, you know, filed a case and said, we think that you guys, that Vandalay had rights are in this easement or abandoned, or that until they have a use for the easement, we should be allowed to do with our ground what we want to do with it. Then maybe the court below's decision would be correct. But that's not what happened, and that's according to Richard Paul. If you just dam the torpedoes and you know that what you're doing is not something that you should be doing, and that there are real rights out there that you're going to encroach on, and you just go ahead and do it anyway, you do it at your own risk. And that's a pretty bright line. And if you ask me, there aren't enough bright lines around in the law. And I think we need that kind of a bright line. It's pretty simple. You can't just take what you want when you want it and not have any consequences, really. And they really don't have any consequences in this situation. The Supreme Court said, and I think it's the Kaiser case, it said if a court allows people, the U.S. Supreme Court, if the court allows people who come to court with unclean hands to get equity, then they are abettors, the court is an abettor of inequity. And it just shouldn't happen.
Has this decision of the Vice Chancellor been recorded in the recorder deeds?
Not yet, Your Honor, but it's definitely on its way.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement and recess.